why don't you tell us what we have lined up this morning?
So every year for the past, I don't know, 6 or 8 years on this edition of Morning Show right before Christmas, we have a show we call The Reason for the Season, and we talk about Christmas and what the meaning of Christmas is. And normally we have done that every year with pastors to give us their view of, you know, how their faith interprets this season and this holiday. But this year we're doing it with folks that aren't current pastors, and we have three in the studio with us. We have with us Paul Graves, and Paul is a regular contributor to the Spokesman Review's Faith and Values column. You can read it about every week, Paul, is it? Or
it's a monthly column.
It's a monthly, okay. Yeah.
The fourth Monday.
The column's out every week, but you rotate with other writers.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
You're also a retired minister from the United Methodist Church and a former mayor of Sandpoint. Thanks for joining the conversation. We also have with us Phil Domus. And Phil, say hi so people get your voice.
Hello.
You're an active member of St. Joseph's Roman Catholic Church, as well as a retired educator.
Correct.
Okay.
Yes, good to be here.
And our third speaker this morning is Julie McCallan, and she is the pedagogical director at the Sandpoint Waldorf School. And Waldorf schools are interesting because they are non-sectarian and non-denominational, but they follow a philosophy called anthroposophy. And you could tell us just a little bit about what that is.
Well, anthroposophy is the philosophy that was developed by Rudolf Steiner in Germany and Austria, and it's really the philosophy behind Waldorf education and many other anthroposophical endeavors in the world, like biodynamic agriculture. But it's really, anthroposophy means the study of what it is to be human, and it's really that acknowledgement that there is spirit in all of us, and how do we bring forth that spirit and honor it?
Yeah, it holds there's a spiritual view of human nature in the world. And one of its stated goals of its curriculum is to imbue the child with a sense that the world is good.
That's
be nice if we could do that.
That's beautiful.
Yeah. Well, with that said, let's jump in on the main topic here. There's a lot of different offshoots. So we want to explore what's the meaning of Christmas. And I think the best way to start out is to ask our three guests, you know, individually, what is the meaning of Christmas for you? And Paul Graves, why don't you tell us, what does Christmas mean to you?
So much. I've realized over the years that I have a tendency to overanalyze things. And I've probably done that with Christmas. Because the reasons for the season are both really very positive reasons and some not so positive reasons. I was thinking back to a Christmas Eve, or excuse me, a Sunday morning service in in December of 1969, over in the Vancouver area where I was serving a church. And we had a beautiful Christmas tree sitting on the sanctuary floor, just not too far in front of the pulpit where I was standing. And I had chosen that particular Sunday to talk about commercialism. I'm not a favor, or I wasn't a fan of it then, and I'm still out of sorts about the overemphasis on commercial Christmas. But I was, I don't rant, but I was, you know, whatever my form of ranting was, I was talking about commercial Christmas. And the tree fell over.
Oh.
Just on cue.
As you were speaking.
As I was speaking. Okay. Yes. It also happened, you know, there was a moment of panic and then laughter, and some folks in the church picked the tree up and secured it, and I went back to finishing my sermon. It happened that my boss was in the congregation. Now, in the United Methodist Church, our bosses are called district superintendents, and he and his wife had chosen to stop in for that Sunday. After the service was over, I was greeting people, and I wondered what he was going to say. And all he he was a gracious, big smile man. He came out and he just had a big smile. He says, "You're a powerful preacher, Paul." It's so easy for me to get distressed with the commercialism, but I find my own spirit coming back into a center place as I do some study, whether it's a formal Advent study that we have in our church, or whether it's my own personal reflections, coming into however we describe the manger scene. It's important for me to walk into that cave stable and try to imagine the smell of the animals and what a strange place for a baby to be born. But I can't stop there. If I do, it romanticizes the whole story to the point where it loses that reason. I think the birth of Jesus in its own way was something of a political act on the part of God, because it was a very tangible reminder that God doesn't come into the castles, but into the lives of ordinary people, and that God comes as a way of reminding us that justice and love and peace are far greater than any cultural habits that we have, that we can develop and have developed over the centuries. So I'll stop there and jump in later.
Well, Phil Domus, what's the meaning of Christmas for you?
Well, it's I've thought a lot about that since you posed the question, and sometimes we don't have to address these questions. But I think one of the advantages of aging and being in the last quarter of life is that somehow things get a bit simplified. And I think, so the meaning of Christmas, it has to do with hope and innocence and trust. And when I think of the story of Jesus's birth as told in the Bible, that's history. It's a story, and then there's her story, Mary's story, and that part of it, but it's really our story, and the point is that we become hope, we become light for the world, and so it's not either or. That did happen. There was a historical Jesus and some event, but again, we're called upon to live that out and to be the light, to be the hope. And the commercialism, I've learned to kind of, I look at the lights in the city and I try to think how they call on me to be light. And I can't say that I'm a fan of starting the whole season on October 1st or whenever we're doing it, but I try to assume good intentions on the people who are doing that, which is sometimes difficult. But it's all about what we're called to do. And somewhere, I think in the scripture, it says, if you can't love your neighbor who you see, how can you love God who you don't see? And I think that's what we're called to do.
Mm-hmm. Julie? What's the meaning of Christmas for you?
Well, mine is pretty inseparable from how we celebrated at the Waldorf School, having been a Waldorf teacher and now a director for over 20 years. It's so entwined in my own personal habits as well as the habits we have at school and kind of the life of anthroposophy that I study. Really, it is that light that Phil talked about. And that sense that in the Waldorf School, we start to bring that message as soon as we start to go into the dark side of the year. We have many festivals that lead into that sense of how do I find my inner light and bring it out into the darkness. And for me, one of the most special ceremonies of the Christmas season is what we do at the Waldorf School. It's called the Advent Spiral or Spiral of Light. Where we lay evergreen boughs. It used to be inside, but we don't have room in our building anymore, but now it's outside, and it's laid out in a spiral. And there's a candle in the center of the spiral, and children enter one at a time with their candle and walk into the center at a slow pace and then light their candle, and then somewhere along the way they set their candle down along the path. So gradually their own inner light, or that symbolism of their inner light being placed along the way to be a guide to other people along the path. To me personally, that's the quiet mood of Christmas, and one we want to bring to the children so it isn't just the commercialism. And the children get all excited and they have fun, and I must say I love decorating my Christmas tree and making gifts and that outward gesture of Christmas. And then what we have as practicing in anthroposophy, and most of the teachers really practice this too, is we have the 12 days of Christmas, which are actually, it's the holy nights after the Christmas. And to me, that's then moving out of this outer gesture of Christmas into this inner time of reflection, that time till Epiphany, when we can really go deeply inward and reflect on our past year and our intentions going forward, kind of likening it to the seeds in the ground that are waiting for spring to come so they fully sprout. How do we want to bring forth into the light of the world our best intentions to make the world a better place out of that inner reflection during those holy nights?
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the Advent spiral that the kids do, and the really neat thing, having been to some of those, is that when all the kids are done, you have this really lit up, neat, a beacon of light, if you will.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it does occur right around our darkest time.
And some of the things I'm hearing, especially having known the Waldorf School for all these years, is bringing that sense of reflection and renewal. You see it in the children, and it's a balance to everything that's out there. And so when I think of what people can do who have children, since children are really the center of our lives, they're still learning about the world, is to give them that balance and a place to reflect. And take both of our children, Chris, went to the Waldorf School, and they still have that. They're men now. And so
mine's got kids of his own
with
now.
With two grandchildren.
That's right.
Should I say their names? No. I know that's the center of your world now, but really to bring that to them is so essential. Something balancing everything else so we can find that within ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
Paul has a comment.
Yeah, well, as you were talking about that, Susie, a new metaphor came to my mind about Christmas, and that is seeds. Mm-hmm. We don't talk about seeds in relation to Christmas, and yet everything that we do, whether it's healthy or not healthy, we're planting seeds in the lives of our children. And, to carry the metaphor a little bit, that seems to be one of the things that the Christmas tradition, as spoken in the Gospels, was doing. God was planting seeds in the hearts and the souls of humanity to consider a different kind of living than what they had experienced before. I think about the gift giving that we have adopted over the last number of years with our family. We have a small family. We have a son and a daughter-in-law and three grandchildren. And the Christmas gifting was was getting a bit silly and expensive.
Over the top.
Pretty much. Yeah.
Stressful.
And so Sue and I decided that we were going to change that for us and hopefully change that that mentality for our children. And so we started, we've probably been doing this 10 years, going through Heifer International and picking out different projects and giving each of our five the gift of chickens.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes we give one of them a
goat.
Well, yeah, goat, yeah. Bees, various kinds of animals, and also stoves.
Mm.
Okay.
Because these, you know, they move these projects into the lives of people in third world countries, primarily, I think, and in hopes of not just giving them some sustainability, but perhaps a little bit of income as they sell to other people.
Mm-hmm.
Our family over in the Portland area has finally picked up on that and realized that they are able to give to other people. Our two adult children, and our grandchildren, who are all in their early 20s, they're all they're marvelous givers,
mm-hmm.
in so many different ways, and we like to think that those were some of the seeds that we helped plant.
It sounds mm-hmm. like you're trying to bring balance into this season that is so big. Mm-hmm. And some meaning. It doesn't mean that we can ignore the fact that the streets are lit up, but what does that mean for us? And things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Something a little different. It's always there. There's always ways to do it with balance.
Mm-hmm. Well, Phil, do you have a thought on that? The whole idea of gift giving, which is...
I was just going to say, when my grandchildren are younger, they're still 10 and under. And so with them, it's a matter of having the balance. They're still into the, the gifts and the commercial part of Christmas, but bringing that other, talking about the broader meaning, having the kind of ceremonies that you're talking about for Christians, talking about who this Christ is. He is, the light of light, which is not different, part of all the lights. So I think it's the both and. And then hopefully wean them from that as they get older.
Well, so how do you, we also have this other big figure around Christmas time, Santa Claus. And for that age group, because I have a granddaughter who's 3, just starting to get the concepts here. How do you pull them back from Santa Claus being kind of the central figure of the season and put it more on, mm-hmm. on Jesus, assuming that's part of your faith tradition?
Well, I think kids are amazing. I think they can hold things in tension. They can deal with the both and, where adults always can't. So I think they can have Santa Claus, a giver of gifts to some extent, and they can understand the broader message. I think it's a matter of talking, exposing, doing ceremonies,
Julie, why don't you speak to that, since you have a lot of kids in your life?
Well, I think it's also about, that's fun. For the children, Christmas is a lot of fun, and that is that outer gesture of Christmas. And I wouldn't want to take that away from them, but it can be balanced also with where can they find ways to give. And sometimes it's slowing it down and making Christmas gifts as opposed to going out and buying them, because then they have personally put time into the gift. And children love to make things, mm-hmm. and we make things a lot at the Waldorf School. And then I think it's also taking the time, if one can, in the home life to find those moments of pause. What I like to do personally is, and you have to be very safe about it, but I have a few candles on my Christmas tree, and each night of the holy nights, of those 12 nights of Christmas, I light a candle. And it doesn't have to be on the Christmas tree. You could have it on a table. But that's my time to kind of reflect on that light in the darkness. And so for children, too, they can live into that. They love to be part of those kind of ceremonies. And they can even be a part of making candles, too. Those kind of things, I think, deepen it and bring them into having a personal connection with finding their light and giving it.
In reflecting on that, just finding something with meaning, making presents is always fun. It's really up to the parents because we're their guardians. And I just remember that my son and his father would go to the soup kitchen every year at Thanksgiving and at Christmas. And my son last week went and helped deliver 100 hot meals to the homeless people in Spokane. And he said he loved it through the Calvary Baptist Church there. They do that because that seed was planted when he was very young. And yes, he got presents. He knew about Santa, all those things that kids know, but he also had that experience. So bringing experiences. I know one thing at the Waldorf School, at their Christmas fair, they used to have a store that children could go in and buy presents with a ticket, minimal exchange of money, but they could wrap those presents and then give them to their family that way. And that was significant. So what about you, Chris? You have those two darling grandchildren. Your son went to the Waldorf school, so he probably has the seeds planted too.
Well, this is actually my oldest granddaughter is 3. So like I said, she's just really kind of getting the concepts down, I think, this year. And the youngest one's only 8 months. So she's a little bit, she's happy with anything. She's a great smiler. I'll say that.
She's really cute.
But the thing I like about gift giving is, and I'm not particularly good at it, because really to give a good gift, you want to think about the person you're giving it to, right? And try to figure out, what their interests are. And it's not about the money, right? I really think that inexpensive gifts that are thoughtful are far more impactful than the big gift that's costs a ton, right? But the thing about gift giving at this time of year is that, I look askew at the commercialized aspects of the holiday for sure. But it's the thing I like about it is that it reminds us to think about people and to make gifts to people. And when it comes around every year, and it's like a big, reminder, take your focus off yourself and your daily concerns and think about other people and in ways. So, Paul, do you have a secret for giving a perfect gift?
I've given up on perfection a long time ago. Recently, a class that I lead at our church is an adult spiritual formation class, and just before Advent, we finished a book called Grateful, The Subversive Power of Giving Thanks, written by a religion historian, Diana Butler Bass. And she helped me, anyhow, understand a different depth of gratitude. She talked about the political dimension of gratitude as being a payback for something. It's quid pro quo. I give something to you, now you give something back to me.
It's a transaction almost,
Definitely a transaction. And her alternative suggestion, which I buy into very quickly, is instead of quid pro quo, we look at gratitude as a pro bono act, doing it for the good of somebody else. But it also includes the idea of paying it forward. And in many ways, that's what the Christmas gift is about, is paying it forward. Your 3-year-old is, you say she's getting the concept of Christmas, and she will take that 3-year-old meaning, and in 3 years she'll have a 6-year-old meaning about Christmas. Mm-hmm. She won't be a if she gets a little bit afraid of sitting on Santa's knee like our two-year-old did years ago. Suddenly, she's right there. You know, there's an age developmental thing going on, and when we have in our gray hair years, we have a different sense of meaning about Christmas, about Santa Claus. I chomp at the bit every time I hear Santa Claus is coming to town, because that is definitely a quid pro quo kind of moment. He's checking his list, and that is so contrary to the Christian message. Jesus or God doesn't check the list. It's an unconditional love that resulted in the baby Jesus and in the man Jesus, and hopefully in his followers. So, whether we're paying hope forward, or justice forward, or peace, or you know whatever those wonderful words are, if they have legs and hands and feet and to make a difference in the world. Mm-hmm. That's as close to perfection as we're going to get.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, let's circle back on the whole figure of Jesus Christ. And Phil, why don't you take this one? So who is Jesus for you? He's the center of this holiday,
right?
Whether you're Christian or not, it's right in the name of the holiday, Christmas. How important is Jesus in your life and as part of this holiday? But also, kind of a corollary question there. The Christmas story is that he was born in a family of most modest means, in a manger. And how is that part of the message of Christmas?
Well, I think that is important, that he was born in very... in a very humble circumstance. I actually just read a book where it was talking about actually what that looked like in the early days of Palestine, or what we call Palestine. It was actually probably, he was born in a house, and there was probably a very modest little house, just a little back room for guests, but the back room was probably too small to account for a birth or to have a midwife. And so he was probably born then in the whole common space, and the front of the common space had a place where they brought in the animals at night. Why did they bring them in? Because to warm the house, for one thing, mm-hmm. and because animals were precious and they didn't want to lose them. So at any rate, that the whatever the reality is, he was born in a poor circumstance, and I think the message is that his message is for everyone. I mean, the rich always seem to get their way, so to speak, but the poor, disenfranchised, are often ignored, and I think that's the import there. I mean, who is Jesus, or who is Christ for me? There is Jesus, the historical Jesus, who is, you know, no longer here. That's history, so to speak. There is Christ, who is the light of the world, and to me, it's a very important, it's essential to me, this message, this person, this gift. And I try, you know, I try to do what Jesus asks, which is, you know, to instruct the ignorant, visit the sick, you know, do all those things. I fail and I try, and that's the message, that we keep progressing, mm-hmm. and that's life. That's the Christian life, and that's life.
mm-hmm. Striving.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Striving.
If you are just tuning in, this is the morning show on 88.5 KRFY, and we're talking about the reason for the season. It's our annual show that we do. With Paul Graves, Phil Domus, and Julie McCallan. Julie, Any thoughts on that?
Well, the phrase that keeps coming to mind is it's an anthroposophical meditation that's called the foundation stone, and it talks about the spirit light of the world entered the sphere of darkness. And really, that to me is the Christ spirit, is that sense that hope and light entered into the world, and it's continually entering into the world, and it's up to us to find, to rebirth it in our own being. It's the sense that every year at this time, it's kind of like the Christ child is within us, and we have the option to birth that child in our deeds and in the way we treat one another. And really, in one sense, it's non-denominational. It's beyond any sect of Christianity. In anthroposophy, there's also an honoring of the other world religions and realizing they kind of all weave together in terms of messages of hope and light. And in anthroposophy, it's the sense that they all pointed to the spirit light of the world, the Christ entering the sphere of earthly darkness. But yeah, it's up to all of us. And with children, it's up to us to try to guide them in ways that they can discover it from themselves in whatever spiritual way they choose to manifest it in their life when they grow up. But to, again, plant those seeds of awareness of others and awareness of their own spiritual uniqueness. And this time of year offers that opportunity in a beautiful way.
Mm-hmm. Paul, you've kind of addressed that question, but especially as you talked about, you've already kind of addressed the idea that was born of very modest means. But as the center of the holiday, of this holiday, what would you say to people that maybe they don't buy into the whole Jesus is the Son of God, but they understand that he's the center of the holiday still?
Okay. So that would require me not preaching but listening. I think it's important for us to engage people in conversation that lets them find their own spiritual space in front of us by helping us understand what their hope for in this particular season. Mm-hmm. Part of the reality of that conversation is to listen to when they don't have hope. This is a tough season for so many people. I feel so fortunate that all of my, at least my conscious life, I've been surrounded by people who love me, and I know that as I've gotten older and more experienced with other people, I found so many people don't have that kind of positive experience, and so listening to their hopelessness and looking or listening for a glimmer of hope in what they're saying, I think is so critical. And I think that's very Jesus-like.
Mm-hmm.
Jesus was, I don't think that Jesus was trying to make the people that he engaged with more religious. I think that he was encouraging them to be more human, which covers the whole gamut of human experience. In his adult life, he challenged the religious people, the Pharisees, the Sadducees. He challenged the Roman authority in very dramatic and eventually fatal ways. But it was a challenge to make them different than they were before. Julie, you were talking a little bit about the holy days after, and that 12 days of Christmas in some traditions is more important than what leads up. And I can fully understand that. But when you use the word holy, I got thinking, okay, one of the descriptions of holy, one of the synonyms for holy that most people don't even know about is the word different. What makes something holy is because it's different than what we're normally used to. And, you know, Christmas for me has to be different in some ways, whether it's giving those gifts to our grandkids that they, and they know that they're helping somebody, or our 20-year-old's grandson has been spending the last 3 weeks of his college term. He's in a social work program at Western Washington, and he's been working at a homeless shelter. And he was telling us about this the other night. We didn't know that he was even doing this, but he got he wasn't tearing up, but he was emotional about the kinds of contact that he was making with people. He's an artist, and he found somebody who was doing art in her life as a homeless person, and he said, "Can we put some of your artwork up on the wall?" Well, that was I think that was probably planting a seed of acceptance, of validation. That is so good in just the simplest kinds of ways. It doesn't take much for us to act in a Jesus-like way or a Christ-like way.
Well, let's see what Phil and Julie have to say about the question of sadness, because for some folks this is a really sad season. They, especially when they reflect on people that they've lost that used to be with them for Christmas, or if they could be struggling for other reasons. And I don't know if you have any of those experiences in your life, Phil.
Well, I think of one. When I was 17, my sister, who was 18, was killed in an automobile accident, and so she died in late August, and so it was a very difficult. There were four. I have three brothers, and there was the one sister, so it was a very difficult time for my family. And that Christmas holidays after death are very difficult. And happily, what made us get through it and be able to celebrate was, one, our faith, but also the friends who surrounded us. And again, like Paul said, it's a matter of they were simply there. They were simply present. They listened. They didn't, try to buoy us up or lift us up with their words, but simply being there and sharing the season. So I think, people who are hopeless, you simply need to be there for them and listen to them and, again, look for that hope within the hopelessness.
Mm-hmm. Julie, In the Waldorf School, you have lots of different families. I'm sure there are some families that might struggle this time of year. I don't know if the school has any particular way of helping those folks.
We're lucky to have our what we call our parent circle, which is the parents who really help us do our task and surround the school. And they are very good about being that warmth mantle of reaching out to families who may have maybe just had a birth of a child and be needing meal trains or things like that for them, but also if there's been a death in the family or a need, being there to provide for them and to let other community members know, here's somebody who could use an extra helping hand. I was reminded as we were talking about this, the lovely story in the Reader last week of the child who at the age of 4 started to give gifts to the homeless. And that's something I've shared with some of the teachers, going, this is a wonderful story for children to hear, because they can realize, oh, a child can be an agent of change too, an agent of how to bring hope to the hopeless. Because that story of just her innocence and her love is kind of a message to all of us. You don't have to have lots of money. You don't have to be this big person to have a big impact.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, Susie?
Well, I was just thinking while everyone is talking, I agree with everything. The Holy Nights have always been special since I've been involved with Waldorf Education. And they start on Christmas Eve and go to the Epiphany. And, you know, everyone talks about your New Year's resolution. Well, really, if you go inward and reflect and find the light within and find a deeper meaning, it's kind of a renewal. And it's so that at the Epiphany, you can say, I'm going to walk into the next year with a little bit more understanding of what I could do different, what I could do better, what I could bring into the world through my own actions and things like that. So that's what I was just thinking while we were talking, but also how music is a common denominator in our lives and how children love music. There's choirs everywhere. I saw the other day here in Sandpoint on the corner right by the Reader, a whole group of people, I don't know where they showed up from, but they were all singing and people were standing around and the snow was coming down. I said, this is part of the picture of Christmas, getting together with people and maybe singing. Because that's what we used to do. Mm-hmm. Somebody would have a piano or the music and singing. And I know we do a lot of that at the Waldorf School. But everywhere, I'm sure in our own homes we can do that. And
Yeah, I was with a little group that would go around and do caroling there for a few years. Uh-huh. It was kind of fun to knock on a door. And believe me, I'm not a good singer. So I was I was dialing my voice down. But it was just fun to take part in that, right? Mm-hmm. So I'd share the Christmas spirit that way.
But every group needs a good door knocker.
That's right. Pretty good at that, yeah. So, well, do you guys have a best Christmas or most memorable Christmas that sticks out for you? Paul, a particular one that pops to mind, and what made it special in any way?
The only thing that I think of, and it was when I got my first bike. I was 9 or 10, and we lived in a house that had a basement and a coal furnace. And I was kind of expecting a bike. By that time, I was pretty sure that Santa Claus was, during every day looked like my dad. But I came downstairs. My bedroom was upstairs. I came down, and there was no bike by the tree. And I was deflated, and I don't remember how my folks steered me toward the basement, but there it was. Mm-hmm. It was down by the coal furnace, and why they chose that place, I don't know. But anyhow, and I was so excited, and yet I was so deflated because we had a lot of snow that year, and they weren't going to let me take it out in the snow. so I had to learn some patience about waiting for the time to enjoy the present. Mm-hmm. But it was a beautiful bike.
It
good
definitely
memory.
Made an impression. Phil, how about you? Any particular Christmas memory?
Well, I think like Paul, one of them's from when I was probably 4 or 5 years old, and my brothers gave me a bowl for my cereal, and it was like a ceramic bowl, and they got it at the thrift store, and I was just elated that they thought of me and gave me something that was my very own, a bowl that I could eat my cereal out of. And the other Christmases that are especially memorable are when there were my grandchildren were infants, and there were babies in the family, and it was so close to the heart of the season.
Mm-hmm. One of my favorite Christmas memories is when I was in the Peace Corps in Ecuador in my mid-20s. And it was down on the coast in Ecuador, and there weren't Christmas trees. And the day before Christmas, my husband had gotten very sick. He had an awful headache and all night long. And we thought, okay, and our best friend who was at another site about a 5-hour bus ride away wasn't likely to be able to come. She had said that she couldn't make it to our, because we were going to celebrate Christmas together. But I thought, well, I have to do something. Christmas to me is always, I want to do something that marks the season. So there weren't evergreens around, at least not the kinds we think of as evergreens, but nearby there was, it was some kind of tree, I don't even know what it was called. It didn't have leaves, it just had kind of green sticky things all over it. But I thought, okay, I can take a branch of this and stick it in a bucket of sand, and I can find some things that'll decorate it. And so I got that going, and our family, the Christmas tradition is to make Swedish tea ring for Christmas breakfast. And I thought, okay, I'm going to go ahead and do that. And did that, and then my husband woke up feeling much better, and then in through the door walked our best friend, who was also a Peace Corps volunteer. And it was just that moment of, wow, Christmas happened anyway. Even though we were in Ecuador, far away from family, we had a beautiful Christmas. And I don't even remember what gifts we had made one another, but it was really that sense of, oh, that camaraderie and that love and that health and warmth. Mm-hmm.
Susie, come on, give us a Christmas
memory. I wasn't really thinking of that. I was thinking about what song we should play when we're done here. But
yeah, we got just a few more minutes. But
probably the first 5-6 years after my son was born, because it was a beautiful time as young parents and trying, we were involved with the Waldorf School as he got a little bit older and seeing how we could bring something magical into his life that would take him into his adult life. And I think we did a good job. So,
yeah,
just those years were special.
Mm. So I'll tell one.
Yes, please. Chris Besser.
When my son was about, 7 or 8 or something, he really wanted to get a ferret for Christmas. And he just went over and over, a ferret. And Cindy and I were like, oh, ferret's not a good idea. We came up like on Christmas Eve, and I finally said, okay, I got to get him a ferret. I was able to find one ferret from somebody that was selling them, it wasn't even a pet store or anything. And I had to build a cage, and I was able to sneak it in and put it upstairs, and got the ferret into his cage where he couldn't be seen. And we went, so we got up the next morning, of course, there was no ferret under the tree, and he could see that. And he kept opening up presents, and I had one little present that just said, go upstairs, right? But he didn't get around to it, and he was just about to like, there's no ferret. And finally I put the parrot in the press in his hand, and he opened it up and he ran upstairs, and he was thrilled to have a ferret. Will say that ferret was a kind of a trying animal to have around the house. They're really cool though. They're interesting animals, and he lived a long, happy life as a ferret.
Charlie, the ferret?
No, it was Friskers.
Friskers the ferret.
Yeah, Nate named him
Be
Friskers.
Be it a ferret or a bicycle, right? Yeah. It all happens.
So anyways, that was just one time when doing a gift was kind of cool. Well, we have just a couple minutes. Anybody want to throw out any last Christmas wish to the folks that are listening? Paul?
I'm still looking for the magic formula, as I think countless other people are, to make Christmas longer than a single holiday. And I think if we can remember that every act of love, every act of hope that we generate in our own personal lives adds to the weight of possibility. I'm suddenly thinking of the the one snowflake on the roof that, that causes the all the snow to come down, adding all of that. We have so much to be thankful for, and so much to be hopeful for. And we kind of let it sort of drift away when we aren't intentional about loving, and especially loving those that don't seem to be loving us back.
Mm-hmm. So bring that to the fore. Phil?
Well, I would echo what Paul says as in his ministerial voice there. And I would just say that, you know, I think the kingdom of God is within us. And if we can get in touch with that kingdom, that Christ, and learn to share it in any small ways, then the problems of the world will seem less and maybe lessened and made better.
Mm. Julie?
Oh, I loved what Paul said as the definition of holy, being different. And I think to me, that would be my Christmas hope, is that we can all learn to honor the differences in everyone around us and not be so divisive in our kind of, you're this and I'm that, and we can't talk to one another, but really going, no, there's there is a holiness in our differences, and to really find that in each other.
Mm-hmm. Well, nice.
That was beautiful. Yeah. Thank you, everyone, for coming
in
today.
Yes, Paul Graves, Phil Domus, and Julie McCallan, thank you so much for coming in to talk about the reason for the season.
Yeah, it was really lively and inspirational. So thank you so much for your thoughts. And
I learned some good, some wonderful things here. Thanks for letting me be a part
of it.
I'm
inspired.
Yep, that's what we're here for, right?
Exactly. Yes.
And we want to remind our folks that are listening that tomorrow on the morning show, Jim and Jack Peterson will be here by himself with Rich Del Carlo about and they'll be talking about the upcoming Audubon Christmas bird count.
Mm-hmm. That happens every year on Christmas Day, I think, right? That morning they go out and you can contribute to the counting of birds, and it's actually it's citizen science, if you will. Yeah,
yeah, really cool. And next week, Chris, you're going to be talking with local journalists, kind of do a wrap-up of the year.
We're
going to
talk about the biggest local stories of the year here. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're going to be talking with Ben Olson, and we're hoping to get someone from the Daily Bee. Ben Olson from the Reader.
There you go. Mm-hmm. Anything else you want to say, Chris?
Well, my Christmas wish for everyone is to just kind of echo what Julie said. Remember, we have so much more in common than we have apart. And we're living a divisive time now, but I hope everybody will practice kindness with everybody else.
I agree 100%. Mm-hmm. Perfect. So with that, we go out into our world. We have a couple songs queued up. Thanks for listening to The Morning Show. If you want to listen to this podcast later in the day, or you want to show it to some of your friends, krfy.org is where you'll find it under podcast. And we thank Keoki for helping us